Thank you, President Sheila. And I will be quick so we can hear our speaker. But first, I must say that I was curious, what does a curator do? And I had to look up the characteristics and qualities of a successful curator, and there were five that immediately jumped out. One, has to be organized, passionate, knowledgeable, adept at multitasking, and proficient at writing. Our next speaker, Dr. Scott Shoemaker, has those qualities in abundance. And you need those qualities because you do much more, as you will hear, than just collect works of art. But you must present and stage those works of art in a way that they inform and they inspire. So Dr. Scott Shoemaker is the curator of Native American art, history, and culture. And in his position, he is responsible for the development of Idle George's collections, relationships with collectors and donors, and will lead development of exhibitions and publications related to the indigenous peoples of North America. He is responsible for the next 25 years of the museum's history. Dr. Shoemaker earned his Bachelor's of Arts degree at Ball State, a Master of Arts in Landscape Architecture at the University of Minnesota, and a Doctorate in American Studies, also from Minnesota. His focus has been on American Indian Studies and Museum Studies. A member of the Miami Nation of Indiana, Dr. Shoemaker is a leading figure in the study and recovery of the Miami language, and he's going to share some of that with us today, and preservation of the traditional art of Miami ribbon work. He lectures frequently at scholarly meetings and cultural gatherings and serves on the board of the Miami Nation of Indians of Indiana and as director of the Historic and Cultural Preservation Office of the Miami Nation of Indiana. This is truly a great gentleman. I had the pleasure of sitting with him, learning more about what he does, and I'm excited to present to you Dr. Scott Shoemaker.
Aya ewe malaka koke niwe akete ni malaka koke no ka kikwe papa gama niwe inzone mema ne myame we meto senya myame gonju wonj pyayani ne me shingo me jake shipaka na ke we makek chikakwe ne machi sen we sip on gonj pyayangi ne meke mo ane Idle George Museum so I just want to thank Michael for that wonderful introduction, for being here today. And I thought it was really important to introduce myself in the Miami language, because that is the language of this place that we are today, and comes from nowhere else on earth. And so the Miami people sprung from this place, and our language sprung from this place, and I'll be talking about that through my presentation. And one of the other things that when we introduce ourselves is we say who we are and where we come from and who our family are. So I also said that my family is the Mishinga Mesha Band and the Shipakanake, also known as the Bundy families. And we come from along the Mississinewa River. And I work at the Idle George Museum now. So I thought it was kind of important, you know, to talk about this. You know, I know it's Native American Heritage Month, but then it's also the bicentennial of the state of Indiana, and that the Miami Nation has played a major role in the literal creation of Indiana. And I want to kind of talk about how my family's related to that. So I want to talk about family. So in a Miami sense, it's much broader idea of family than kind of the nuclear family of mom and dad sort of thing. And it's really rooted in this word, awame. So awame means to literally have your blood relation, but it's also to make somebody a relative. So it encompasses us as human beings and our relationship to one another, our relationship to the physical world, and our relationship to the spiritual world. So we always address everything in terms of kinship, because we see ourselves related to literally everything and everyone. I'm not going to get into sort of the depths of ideas of kinship, but one of the really interesting examples is in Miami sense, your mother, all of her sisters are also your mother, so her children are also your siblings, and your father, all of his brothers are also your fathers, and all of their children are your siblings. So it's a much broader idea of family, and that's something that we always have identified in the broader Miami community is through our extended families. So whenever I meet another Miami person that I don't know, the first thing we say is, "Who's your family?" And then we automatically know how we're connected to one another. And the other part of that is it's a connection to place, too. So this is a map of the Miami homeland with some of the names of the rivers. Some of those names are still kind of in existence today. They've been a little changed over time. But kind of these red dots are my family's connections to these specific places I'll be talking about, and beyond that, which continues today. So the first one is actually where the Miami people began, where Miami history began. It's a place called Sakiweonge, which is right here, which is the confluence of what's known as the St. Joseph River with Lake Michigan, which is now St. Joseph, Michigan. Has a beautiful beach there. And so this is where the Miami history began. We emerged from the river, and this is where we became the Miami people. And it's not important to us when that happened. It's about what happened and where it happened. And then going back through family oral history, the farthest that we know goes back to my ancestor Atahuata and his son Unzeindia, who were band leaders at the time, around the time of the French and Indian War. And we moved to a town called Pinguilinyonge, or also known as Pikawilini, near present-day Piqua, Ohio. And that was a time when we decided to join this settlement that was newly created to be more in trade relations with the British. It was a short-lived town that was attacked by the French and their allies. And then upon that, my ancestors moved to the Mississinewa River river area. Oops. And part of one of the other side of the family I'll be talking about was also living at a place called Kikayonge, which is also known as Fort Wayne. And that was a major Miami settlement. It was a major place of trade that connected us to the Great Lakes and Mississippi watersheds. It was a very intertribal community, so there were Shawnees, Delawares, and Kickapoos, and a lot of other tribes living there. And this was also the time when we tried to stop American expansionism. So we fought a series of very successful battles against the United States. Unfortunately, that came to an end with the Battle of Fallen Timbers and later 1700s. But that began our nation-to-nation relationship with the United States through the Treaty of Greenville in 1795. And that was an agreement for land cessions, but then also peace with the United States. And this this is the signature page from the Treaty of Greenville. So my ancestors were present there. They didn't sign it, but one of the things that they brought back with them was one of these pipes. So a lot of tribal leaders were given pipes as gifts to symbolize that nation-to-nation relationship between us and the United States. And this is a series of the treaties, beginning with 1795, the Treaty of Greenville. So within about a little over 40 years, we ceded basically the vast majority of what is now the state of Indiana, which culminated in the Treaty of 1840. Prior to that, this was our only land base that we had left, which is basically Tipton, Howard, Miami, Grant, and Wabash counties. And then we had some other little parcels of land here that were given to reserved for individuals. So through that process, incredibly shrinking amounts of land culminated again in the idea of removal. So we were seen as kind of obstacles to progress, and that it was sort of posed as it would be beneficial to us to remove ourselves, which we didn't really want to. We were very strategic in avoiding removal several times, and it didn't actually come about until 1846. And so through that process, though, there was a lot of exemptions. So my ancestors had exemptions from removal in the 1840 treaty. Another side of the family had a congressional exemption through removal. So when that happened, a little over 300 Miami people were shipped on a canal boat beginning in Peru, up to Fort Defiance, down to Cincinnati, and then they got on the steamship here. This is the actual steamship Colorado, went down the Ohio River, up the Mississippi, up the Missouri, then marched overland. So it took a month. They arrived about this time. 100 and 70 years ago, I think, if I'm doing my math correct. And all they had were some tents to live in. So it was a very traumatic time. About 300 people remained in Indiana. And so it was a really, it split our nation, it split families, and it's something that we still feel the impact of today. So after removal, you know, we had to try and rebuild ourselves, rebuild our communities, and try to adapt to new circumstances. So in Indiana, we had these very small, tiny parcels of land, mostly in Mississinewa River area, but some others kind of up towards Fort Wayne. In Kansas, the reservation was originally 700,000 acres. There was another treaty signed in 1854 that reduced that, and then it was allotted. So it was previously communally held land, and then it was allotted into individual parcels. And some of my relatives, some of my family went out to Kansas afterwards, and they received an allotment out there. Then in 1867, the tribe was removed again, and this time to Indian territory. But some people, they had the option that they could remain in Kansas, but renounce their tribal citizenship and become U.S. citizens, or they could move to Indian territory. So some people moved to Indian territory and some people stayed in Kansas. A lot of those people in Kansas lost their lands and moved back to Indiana. Some people in Indiana lost their lands and moved out to Indian territory. So there's always been this constant movement back and forth. And my family's been a part of that the whole time too. So going back to my one family, the Mishingamesha Band, so in the 1838 treaty, it reserved this 5,400-acre reservation to the Band of Mitosenia. So Mitosenia was the son of Unzendia, so he was the band leader. So it was held in common for the entire band. And this is a survey that the Bureau of Indian Affairs did in 1873, and it was a very rich landscape. It had forests, wetlands, and prairies, and there was the river that provided a lot of things that helped us in sort of that transitioning and adapting to new circumstances. And I like to talk about this bag, too. So this bag is a special bag for housing medicine. And on one side, it has the abstracted figures of what we call chingwia, which are thunder beings. And in Miami cosmology, they're the beings that control the earth, or the sky, the space of the sky. And on the other side is the abstracted form of, we call it Linapinja, which is the underwater panther, who is a being that controls the earth and the waters. And they're always in conflict with one another, but it's through their conflict that balance on earth is maintained. And us as human beings have to maintain that balance too. And that was the real struggle that we've continue to struggle with, is trying how to maintain a balance and maintaining who we are as Miami people, but then also adapting to new circumstances. So this is just gives you an idea of some of that adaptation of, you know, having to live much more of a sedentary lifestyle, building log cabins. And this is the village that my ancestors established when they moved here from Ohio in the mid-1700s. And that was also a village that was attacked during the War of 1812 by American forces. But again, the village was rebuilt, and we, you know, adapted to that. Down here in this area was kind of a newer village that was came about in the mid-1800s. After removal, a lot of Miami people converted to being Baptists. So there's a Baptist church built, and then a schoolhouse built so that Miami children could learn English and learn how to deal with the outside world. And this is Mishingamesha, who is the band leader. He was the son of Mitosenia, and I'm descended from his brother, whose name was Shapandosya. And these are some objects associated with Mishingamesha. So he was this really instrumental leader during this really rapid time of transition. And this is kind of a colorful figure in Miami history too. So this is Wapamangua or Thomas Richardville. And he's related to me through on the Mishingamesha side through his mother. And his father was a descendant of Jean-Baptiste Richardville, who was an important Miami leader. But he ended up being raised by my family. His father was murdered and his mother died. And so my family, Shapandosia, was living at the Miami settlement at what is now Kokomo in the 1830s. And then when the reservation was formed, they moved there. And he lived there for much of the rest of his childhood. And then he moved up to Fort Wayne and lived on some of the Richardville land up there, married a Miami woman, divorced her, and then went to University of Notre Dame for a couple years. And then he moved out to Kansas, married another Miami woman, got an allotment out there, and he became a really instrumental figure in the how Miami people adapted to circumstances out there. So when removal happened, the United States, in their minds, was that the government of the Miami Nation moved out to Kansas. So they only dealt with the council in Kansas as representatives of the nation. But Thomas Richardville was from here in Indiana, but he was an interpreter, and he kept notes of the council meetings, and he was very instrumental. And this was a delegation that had gone to Washington, D.C. in the 1860s. And then later he moved with them to Indian Territory, received an allotment out there, and was elected the chief of the Mayan tribe of Oklahoma. So again, it's that, you know, that constant movement back and forth. And then finally in 1873, our reservation was allotted, so that was divided into individual parcels. And then by 1881, what's called the trust status dissolved, so it meant that the state could now have jurisdiction over it. It could be taxed. It was originally, as I mentioned, 5,400 acres. It was divided among 63 people. So this is my great-great-grandfather, Mekata Mangwa, and he was 10 years old when that happened, and his allotment was about 100 acres up here. And then his mother, Lenon Zuhkwa, had an allotment right here, and that's her father, Shapandosia. And within a very short amount of time, that entire land base was gone. By 1904, it had gone down to 54 acres, and this little parcel where the original schoolhouse and one of our cemeteries is now all that we hold. And there was just a lot of kind of shady deals and manipulation that happened in terms of how that land came out of our hands. And then through this is just one story of many Miami people in dispossession of land, and a lot of us had to move to nearby towns to survive. On the other side of the family is the Shipakanake, so descendants of the war leader Shipakana, also known as Deaf Man. And this is an image of his village on the Mississinewa River, and then a building that was still standing in the 20s there. He's probably more famous for his wife, who is in Miami named Makunzakwa, which means little bear woman, also known as Frances Slocum. I'm sure a lot of people from Indiana have probably heard of her. But she was a captive. She was born a Quaker in Pennsylvania, taken captive by a Delaware as a small child, and married a Delaware man, divorced him, and then married Shipakana, and lived the rest of her life as a Miami person. And this is her wearing blanket, which is at the Wabash County Historical Society. And it's things like this that got me interested in ribbon work, which I'll talk about in a little bit. And this is a wampum belt that belonged to Shipakana. I think it's still on exhibit at the Indiana State Museum in their 200 objects exhibit. But it's covered in vermilion, which is something associated with war. So it was sold by my relative Camillus Bundy back in the 20s. So they had two daughters, and this is one of the daughters, Unzashinikwa, and this is one of her fifth and final husband, Peter Bundy, or Wapa Pito is also his name. So it's interesting that Peter wasn't born in Miami. His father was a French trader, and his mother was Mahican. And the Mahicans came here with the Delaware in the late 1700s, early 1800s. But then he was adopted into the Miami Nation, and he was one of the leaders that signed that treaty in 1854. So again, going back to the idea that relatives, it's beyond sort of blood, you can make people relatives. And then their son, Camillus Bundy, so my great-grandmother's second marriage was to his son, David Bundy. And then, as I mentioned, they had a congressional exemption from removal. And then later on, they received a 640-acre reserve that was, I found it in the National Archives, the original deed signed by President Zachary Taylor when I was there. And It reads, to be held in trust for her and her sister and their heirs forever. So it's to be held in trust, so not under jurisdiction or taxation by the state. But in 1897, there was a pretty devastating decision by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It basically said, the Miamis in Indiana are no longer Indians, and therefore we no longer have a relationship or responsibility towards them. So that meant that our lands could now be taxed. Camillus refused to pay taxes on his land, and it was seized. He was removed by gunpoint, and he camped out on the graves of his ancestors. And my grandfather grew up in the city of Wabash, and he would always come down with his stepdad, David, and bring Camillus groceries and those sorts of things. And then finally, when he was forced from the land, that he lived the rest of his life with my grandfather. So he's very instrumental in his life. And then it's around this time that our relatives started doing what's called the Makunzaqua pageant. So really seeing the need to really educate people about Miami history and to say, you know, we haven't disappeared. We're still here. But also that knowing that people recognize that, you know, authentic Native people had to look like the Plains Native people. So they had to draw people in to sort of play, you know, this part of being a Plains Native person, but using the story about Francis Slocum to tell it from their perspective. And it was also a way to earn money, too. It ran during the Depression. But it was a really important time for young Miami people to speak the Miami language and do Miami things when in their daily lives they couldn't do some of those things. And then kind of going back to some of my interest and is looking at a lot of these old family photographs and asking my grandfather, well, why don't we have these things anymore? And, you know, because of this land loss and dispossession, all these sorts of things, that we had to sell a lot of these. So a lot of these really cherished clothing and family heirlooms went to collections like that are part of National Museum of American Indian now, or the Cranbrook Institute of Science in Michigan, or the Milwaukee Public Museum, and scattered all over the place. So one of the things that I got interested in was, well, you know, let's try and start doing this again. So I started connecting the collections to family photos, that we can connect them to families and to reclaim the practice of ribbon work. So we've been doing that. These are some workshops we did last year in Oklahoma and here in Indiana to really get the community excited about it. And I really equate kind of the ribbon work in terms of what we've been doing with our language too. So our last fluent speakers died in the 1960s, and when that happened, linguists labeled our language as being extinct. We like to say that it was sleeping or it was dormant at that time, because our language is very well documented. When the Jesuits came in the 1600s, they began writing our language down. So we have about 300 years of documentation. So in the early 90s, a tribal member and a linguist started working together to get the language back in the community. And I really see it as that the language was dormant, that it was, and those objects in museums were dormant, and it took us finding them and reconnecting with them to reawaken them, and then we reawaken ourselves through that process. So this is an image of a camp held on the Mississinewa River back in the early 90s. It encompasses Miami people from here in Indiana, Miami people from Oklahoma that came to travel. And then I go out and other people go out to Oklahoma and we do kids camps, and it's really getting the community excited, and it's a real healing experience for all of us. And we've been producing a lot of materials, and it's a very powerful thing for us to reconnect with these. And that, you know, that we're making new stories that are really connected to place and are connected to our families. And so that's it. Thank you for listening.